going to start with Mr. Taylor's bills. What are they, 23?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's House Bill 2216, House Bill 2217. The proponents of House Bill 2218, all three be coming from the Department of Justice, have asked that the bill be withdrawn. You have the House Bill 2216 for work session and House Bill 2217 that relate to antitrust. Andy Obertine is here from the Department of Justice, as is Jim Gardner, to talk about the agreement they have reached in House Bill 2217.
All right, so 2218 is asking to withdraw.
That's dead. Right. With the amendments and the agreement that they have, there's no need for 2218.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2216 removes the limitations and jurisdictions set forth in the legislative purpose section, R646715 of Oregon's antitrust laws, by stating that as legislative purpose that Oregon's antitrust laws apply to interstate trade of commerce and to interstate trade of commerce as well. Mr. Obertine can probably describe it a lot better than I can. He practices in the area. He's here, and you probably would want to have him come up to the witness table. So he with
right.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Gardner, Mr. Obertine.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Andy Obertine with the Oregon Department of Justice.
And my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm here today representing Microsoft Corporation.
Chairman Minnis, I previously testified in support of House Bill 2216. That is the bill that would amend the Oregon Antitrust Act so that the prohibitions of the Oregon Antitrust Act would extend to conduct in interstate commerce as well as just in intrastate commerce, so that a violation of the Oregon Act, even though the conduct extended beyond our state borders, could be addressed by the Oregon Antitrust Act. There have been no changes to that bill since I last testified.
All right. That's 2216, right?
That's 2216.
No changes. We're trying to shuffle our papers around to make sure that we've got all the amendments and appropriate bills in front of us. So. And Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have no objection to 2216.
Okay. Work session 2216. Anybody like it?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2216 to the floor of the due pass.
Get down to it.
We'll stand at ease and
so go ahead.
Okay. Just have somebody in line, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Metzger moves. So I'll place the motion, House Bill 2216, unamended, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, and Senator Beyer, do you want to move?
Looks great.
Okay. Any other discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
The bill. 2217. Mr. Chair, did you get a chance to sign or carry? Okay, sorry, I don't hear that one over here.
Robertson. Chairman Minnis, members of the committee, House Bill 2217 has been amended since I last appeared. The amendments appear in the -1 version of the bill. This is a compromise bill that is supported by the Oregon Department of Justice. It was designed to address the concerns that were articulated by Mr. Gardner on behalf of his clients, as well as concerns that were raised in a meeting that I had with Mr. Gardner following our testimony in support of 2217. Along with me at that meeting, Mr. Taylor appeared at the meeting, as well as Betsy Earle from Associated of Oregon Industries. We believe that we have resolved the initial concerns that related to the bill. Mr. Gardner, of course, can speak to that as well. The bill is changed in the following respects. The businesses or business entities no longer have indirect purchaser standing under the bill, so they no longer have a right or a remedy for a damages relief as indirect purchasers. Consumers, the state and its political subdivisions remain as having indirect purchaser remedy, but that remedy is vested exclusively within the Attorney General, so that only the Attorney General's office can bring those actions on behalf of consumers, the state, political subdivisions, as indirect purchasers. Those are the two amendments to the bill. Again, we believe that we have addressed initially the concerns that were raised. We believe it's still a very good bill and should be passed. I might add that there are still some issues that need to be resolved, and Mr. Gardner and I have agreed to work together in the interim to conduct an interim study on the remaining issues, including whether we can completely eliminate any risk of multiple treble damages awards that may result from indirect purchaser cases, along with perhaps broadening the scope of indirect purchaser remedies as part of that study.
Who's going to pay for the study?
The Oregon Department of Justice is going to handle all of the expenses related to the study.
All right, Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I agree with the testimony that was just offered, and in particular, this bill, the amendments by withdrawing the private right of action eliminate the prospect of multiple treble damages at various levels of distribution, which was our primary area of concern, and we look forward to working with the Attorney General and other interested entities in the business community and in the consumer community during the interim to further pursue this issue and issues related to the indirect purchaser doctrine. We commend your attention to the dash ones.
All right.
Yeah, has everybody got the dash ones?
Okay, we are in work session.
Dash one amendments to House Bill 2217.
Okay. Senator Beyer moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 2217. The discussion? Any objection? No objection.
Chair, move House Bill 2217 as amended by the committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves the adoption of House Bill 2217 as amended to the floor of the Senate. Moves the bill to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Order. I'll again carry that one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And 2218 is dead. 2818 is dead. All right. Public hearing, House Bill 2202.
Mr. Chair, 2202 was passed out of this committee about a week and a half ago. What you have in front of you, the B5 amendments, are conflict amendments. They've been checked out by everybody that's concerned and are A-OK, ready to go.
All right. Hang on just a second. This was passed out of committee?
That's correct.
And so what we have are conflict amendments.
That's correct.
Five amendments. All right, so we need a motion
to reconsider.
Consider. Yes.
Here, I better make sure I voted on the surveillance side.
Yes.
Not a guarantee.
Not a guarantee, that's right.
Does the staff know if that's the case?
I'm sorry? I can't hear you.
I guess I better make sure I voted on the surveillance side before I make a motion to reconsider the vote.
Everybody voted for it except for Senator Beyer, who was excused.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 2202.
Okay, Senator Messer moves that
we reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 2202 be engrossed. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. Any objections to reconsideration? Hearing none. And now we need a motion to adopt the dash 5 amendments, the B5 amendments, which are conflict amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5, the B5 amendments.
B5. All right. Senator Metzger moves the adoption of B5 amendments to House Bill 2202. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none.
Who is the designated carrier?
Senator Courtney.
Senator Courtney will continue to carry this.
We have to pass the bill still.
We haven't passed that
we
yet?
We just did the dash 5.
Gosh, it's really, really early, isn't it?
I do move that we pass it, though, to the floor as amended.
Send it to the floor?
To do a pass.
Senator Metzger moves that we send House Bill 2202 be engrossed as amended before the Senate with a pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Cordy again will carry that bill. Let's see, Representative Williams is here.
3677.
Okay. Public hearing, House Bill 3677. Representative Williams, thank you for visiting with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What was it? 3677.
House Bill 3677 was specifically written to address the manner in which the judicial branch considers what we have done and said in the legislature when they're required to interpret statute. To accomplish its goal, House Bill 3677 amends ORS Chapter 174, which outlines the duties of the court. To understand the proposed change that was adopted in the House committee and passed by the House, you certainly must understand, as I'm sure most of you do, the current approach with respect to legislative history as it's considered by the court. While there are several different opinions as to the court's use and reliance on legislative history, as you know, in a 1993 case styled PGE versus the Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Supreme Court announced in clear terms a strict structure by which the courts would address issues of statutory interpretation. In short, PGE versus Boley said that the court should look at the words and their placement, called text and context, in the court's opinion. And if the court believed that the words were not ambiguous, they would not be required to consider legislative history of the statute. What this means is that they look at the ordinary and regular meaning of the words, and if they could come to a reasonable understanding of the statute, they are not required to consider what we have, may have actually said or done in relationship to those words and their meaning. This may be an efficient methodology for resolving cases, and it can and has in several cases, I believe, led to results that have turned out that would have turned out differently had the courts more fully considered the history and our intent in the body. There was testimony to that effect in committee, even by a current member of the Supreme Court, who is it's appropriate that I state was only testifying in his personal capacity on the bill at my request and not in his official capacity as an associate justice of the court. The failure to consider legislative history, in my opinion, lessens our role as a co-equal branch of government and prevents the court from performing its proper function in attempting to enforce the people's representatives' intent. House Bill 3677 attempts to achieve this careful balance by essentially raising the court's ability to consider legislative history to the same level, not above, but to the same level as text and context. It allows parties in a suit to offer the legislative history to assist the court in interpreting a statute. The bill limits the court's consideration of the legislative history to the offer to that that is offered by the parties, placing appropriately the burden for putting forth the legislative history on the parties in the case. It also allows the court to give the legislative history the weight the court considers to be appropriate. To mandate more would be both problematic and imprudent. We want judges to judge. Frankly, not all legislative history, as you know, is going to be helpful, nor is it going to be instructive. That's in fact why we have judges. But make no mistake, if any court is reading this, my testimony, for the purpose of legislative history, House Bill 3677's intent is to overrule the harsh and limiting construct of PGE versus Boley and to raise the level of consideration the court gives to our actions here. We had considerable assistance in the drafting of the amendments to the bill, the original bill, by the special counsel to the Attorney General in his personal capacity, a member of the Supreme Court. I appreciate the assistance of these individuals in working with the bill, and I would urge this committee support, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Just for staff, we were just past the Dash 1 amendments that appear to have been adopted in the House. So the committee could just disregard the Dash 1 amendments that are already what constitutes the A engrossed version of the bill. So. All right, so let's see. This is a very delicate little bill here in the sense that we're not trying to tread on the work of the court. We're just simply trying to say, gee whiz, honorable justices, should you have a case before you, would you please consider the legislative history and please take it into consideration in your deliberations to the extent that you see it.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an accurate way to describe it. The original language of the bill went further than I had certainly intended in the drafting. I think it's important that the court have the role, and the role that it plays is to determine the weight that it ought to give the legislative history, and not all legislative history is equal. And we need to give them that flexibility. At the same time, under the PG versus Bowley analysis of simply text and context, unless the court read the words to be ambiguous, they would never turn further to the legislative history. And as you know, what special meaning we may have decided to give a particular usage of a word might be very different than what Webster may have provided the meaning of that word. And the only way you know that, frankly, is you look at the legislative history. This bill will now allow individual parties, having researched the legislative history, to put forward the argument that when the legislature adopted a particular statute, they had a particular meaning in mind with particular use of language. And this simply says that the court shall consider that. Doesn't tell them the weight they have to give it, but they at least have to consider it. It takes legislative history and raises it to the equal level with text and context, and then allows the parties, or places the burden on the parties, to bring that forward. So I think it strikes the very delicate balance that is necessary. And there was testimony again from one of the members of the Supreme Court who acknowledged that had this bill been in place and had the court considered the legislative history before it sort of just ignored it under the text and context analysis, several recent cases may have in fact turned out differently. In my mind, that's enough to raise the specter of this issue. And again, I think it's a real balancing test between these co-equal branches of government. But to the extent they're not really looking beyond just the text and context in cases where that would be appropriate, I think it lessens their ability to understand what it was we intended when we did certain things.
All right. Thank you, Representative. Appreciate it. Questions, Senator Burdick and Harper.
Chairman, the Supreme Court has a hierarchy of how they consider legislative history when they get to the legislature. Under current law, when they get to legislative history, if the text and context is clear and they actually go to legislative history, there is a hierarchy. They devote primary emphasis. They start with a carrying statement, and then they go to the floor debate, then they go into committee, as I recall, from the lunch we had today. Would this bill change in any way the Supreme Court goes about looking at legislative history when they look at it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, my understanding is the hierarchy that they may have sort of generally described is certainly not one that I think is identified clearly in any case that they have decided, other than perhaps by drawing comparisons. I do think, and that's why we tell the court that they're allowed to give the legislative history the weight they think it deserves, so we're not altering with sort of how they place emphasis. But I think you would find most of them to say that while there may be a general hierarchy, the carrier or the sponsor of a bill might be given more weight in determining what the legislative history of a particular bill would be than a lobbyist appearing in front of the committee, either on the in favor or the opposed side. I would suggest that is really going to be a case-by-case analysis by the court, as I think it should be. Very difficult to, I think, establish with the level to which we actually keep legislative history in this process, an order or a priority beyond that. And I don't really think they do, except in very general terms, but even they let themselves off the hook in particular cases. And you could see, for example, a bill where, the testimony from the agency who would be required to actually implement the statute, that testimony might in some ways be more important and therefore have greater weight than what a stray member of the building who wasn't sitting on the committee but a member of the legislature might say about it on the floor. So there isn't, I think, a real locked-in hierarchy, but this would not change any of the approach they've currently used and would leave them free to continue to apply whatever standard they wish.
Yes,
one more question, and that is, did you still think this bill was a good idea if you sat on the Supreme Court?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, while it has not ever been my desire to do so, I would tell you that, yes, I would believe that this bill would be a good idea if I sat on the Supreme Court. I think that it's the job of the court, and one, frankly, I believe they do very well to try to divine the intent of the legislature. Their job is to interpret statute and to also apply the Constitution. And I think they do a better job interpreting statute, i.e. figuring out what it was that we intended when they have the opportunity to review legislative history, at least on par with text and context. This bill does not let us off the hook. We still have to mean what we say when we say it. We can't say black and then if we all agree that black meant white, that's not going to work. But to the extent that, you know, Webster may have used a word differently than we intended a word to be used in some of the work that we do, I think it's appropriate that they have an opportunity that the parties to a lawsuit who are arguing about what it is that we do have the opportunity to put that case forward to the court.
Is this what his is? In your learned opinion, you and Representative Williams, is this good as we're going to get?
Well, I think Representative Williams explains it pretty well. I think that the difference is we have a separation of powers problem in that we cannot tell the court what to do. They really cannot tell us what to do except for the Constitution. Well, but it all hinges upon the Constitution and their interpretation of the Constitution. And they've actually gone back and done a similar construction in terms of how they view the Constitution in terms of common law and the original intent of the framers of our Constitution, so on and so forth. So they've applied that very rigid standard there. But we can't really tread there. We can ask them to please consider it, and to the extent that there's a relationship between the court, the legislature, and, of course, the executive branch, there's a dialogue that's kind of ongoing, which makes government dynamic. So we hope that they'll take these things into consideration. I think we had a meeting early on in the session where the Chief Justice advised us that if we were going to establish legislative intent, because they did see that it was important, that both the carriers of the bill in the House and the carrier of the bill in the Senate should, by and large, have pretty much the same speech on the floor, because that's the first place they go when they start to look at legislative intent. So the carriers of the bill, speeches on the Senate floor, speeches on the House floor, if they're substantially the same, then they give that a greater degree of weight. I think part of the admonition should come back and point fingers at us. We should do a better job as legislators of establishing that record. To the extent that we do not, it muddies the water, and they're left with the plain language. So on one hand, we're telling the court, please consider legislative history. On the other hand, we have to kind of point fingers at ourselves and say, in the construction of legislative or statute, we ought to do a better job of establishing that record.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, you hit on an excellent point. Good bill should pass does not really cut the mustard when the court's trying to look at these issues.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, excuse my voice. I don't have one, which is kind of a blessing for a senator, I know. I guess the thing I'd like to kind of get on the record here, in case someday they're reviewing this particular hearing for what the intent was, I have... I've been in committees where a member of the legislative body would say, we believe such and such, and all the committee members are sitting there thinking, no, 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 no. But out of respect, you don't say anything. So I'm assuming that just because a senator has said, we believe, that they wouldn't assume that that was the complete intent of the committee at that particular time. And I just sort of wanted to get that on the record, so when some future Supreme Court justice or his or her staff members are viewing it, that be careful about just taking individual comments from committee members in the intent. And I don't know if that would be included in the deliberations and trying to find...
Senator Duncan, I guess what I would say is that is the duty of the court to give those comments their proper weight and to attempt to divine from those comments and the other context in which the bill passed whether or not those comments should or shouldn't have any value. Sometimes in legislative history, those kinds of comments are referred to as salting the mine. This is not a bill which I am attempting to find a methodology to increase the ability for members of the legislature to salt the mine. On the other hand, the issue of 90 elected representatives being able to speak their view about what they think a bill does is in fact exactly what we have a Supreme Court to try to determine. While I don't encourage salting of the mine, I would also suggest that the role of the court is an appropriate one in determining when something is establishing legislative intent and something else is salting the mine, and that's their mission.
And back to my point earlier, you cannot set forth a legislative intent for the record by not saying anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the court assumes that what's said is part of the dialogue that establishes that. So, that, I mean, you suggest that the court should take into consideration the things that are not.
When you see people nodding their head like that, I assume it doesn't show up very well.
But I guess that's the reason we're here. If you do have disagreement and you have a point, you need clarity to something, it's incumbent upon the legislators to ask for clarification, make sure that they understand it. In the words of one legislator, now deceased, that's the last time I'll ever vote on a bill I don't understand. You know, you got to avoid that kind of thing. There is an assumption I think the court makes that the plain meaning of the words in the bill are, in fact, what they mean based on their current common definitions. And to the extent that there's anything other than that, and I think that's what this gets to. If we all commonly misunderstand Webster, but it's clear from the intent of the dialogue that we meant something other than what Webster meant, then they ought to take that into consideration. Senator Harkin.
Thank you, Senator Minnis. Max, we had this conversation with the Supreme Court, and I asked the question about purpose clauses or whereas clauses, whether they would make a difference, and at that time they told me no. Do you think that would make a difference if we have this legislation get in there and become ingrained, whether we should think about that a little bit more? It's just a general question.
I'm sorry, what was it?
Purpose clauses, whereas clauses, what the bill means, why we're doing this. Would that be helpful if you think if this legislation became...
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I think that if a committee and a body votes on a bill that includes language like a whereas and then sets out what the purpose of the bill is, while I think that is less authoritative than the actual words of the statute that goes to implement that purpose, it's at least a voted on statement of what it was the bill was intended to accomplish. So I think this would move closer to making those kinds of clauses purposeful and meaningful for the court's instruction, somewhat like if there was an adoption of a committee report, for example, that in better, more detailed terms defined, in fact, what the intent of the committee was with the adoption of a particular statute, as they do in Congress. It would be something that would be instructive to the court. Again, I think it would be a case-by-case analysis where the court would have to consider the manner in which those clauses were adopted and whether they were added by only one chamber or whether they were passed by both chambers, for example, might be something that would apply.
Max, you're the only person that signed up today, so we're going to do a little bit of work session.
Chair, I move House Bill 3677 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Metzger moves House Bill 3677 A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Are there any objections? No objections? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And anybody desiring to carry this?
I'll do it.
Senator Metzger. I know.
I can't let you guys have all the money.
Senator Metzger will carry the bill.
We have 50 bills today.
And let's do public hearing on House Bill. Where are we? I'm forgetting my little diagram here. Let me see, Andrew.
I'm glad you have one.
Well, I'm trying to make sense in terms of appropriating the council staff so that we don't have the running all over. Let's see, House Bill 2112, public hearing. Jim Craven.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I promised your Jim Craven, American Electronics Association, for the record. I promised your staff I'd be very brief, but given the preceding conversation, I think I probably need about a half hour here to very carefully establish the legislative intent of the following bill. No? Okay. House Bill 2112 adopts the Uniform Electronics Transactions Act, which is a national model law that comes to this body from the group called NACUSL, which is the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform Laws. The bill has gone through, had extensive hearings in a work group in the House Advancing E-Government Committee, also went through the House Judiciary Committee, passed the House floor 46-0. What the bill does, very briefly, it basically established a legal framework that electronic signatures and electronic records have the equivalent force of law as pen and paper signatures and paper files put in file cabinets. Of course, it's a little more complicated than that. But basically, we are adopting a model law that is passed in, I think, by the end of this legislative year, probably 30 other states. So we're joining a long list of states that have adopted the law. Section, and very briefly, sections 1 through 21 of the bill are UEDA. That's the national model law, and we're adopting it in a straightforward fashion. Section 22 allows for the Department of Administrative Services to work with agencies on adopting rules for electronic signatures. Section 23, the state archivist didn't want to have anything to do with us, so we carved him out. Section 24 provides some explicit consumer protections that mimic a federal statute passed last fall and were urged upon the work group by the Attorney General's office. And sections 25 through 37 are just cleanups with some existing statutes. Section 38 is an emergency clause. The members of the work group on the House side included our organization, the American Electronics Association, the Oregon State Bar Computer and Electronic Information Work Group, the Department of Administrative Services, and the Oregon Attorney General's Office. And I believe I can represent all those groups are in support of the bill. And again, it did pass the House floor 46-0. So with that, I've established my legislative intent, Mr. Chairman.
Good job, Jim. Any questions? Senator Duncan?
Oh, we're not work session yet.
Not yet. We have Pat Lundeen from Department of
Mr. Chair, just one other item. Senator Metzger and Senator Courtney may remember that this was one of the proposals that was advocated by the Oregon Internet Commission during last year and would represent, if it moves through this committee and to the Senate floor, probably the first Oregon Internet Commission recommendation that actually goes into law this session, so it's a good piece of work. Thank you.
Pat, are you here? Do you have anything else you'd like to say that's in addition to?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Pat Lundeen. I'm the state's electronic commerce manager, and I'm representing the Department of Administrative Services and the executive branch agencies today. We're in support of this bill. It definitely supports the governor's executive order on electronic government and the direction that the Department of Administrative Services Director Mike Greenfield wants to take implementing electronic government as an enterprise. This is enabling legislation, allows agencies to accept electronic transactions for any business process they choose. The intent of Section 22, as Jim Craven stated, was to make sure the Department of Administrative Services coordinates the establishment of standards for how e-government will be implemented and enforce those with the enterprise. And that's all of my testimony.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And let's do a little work session. 2112. Senator Duncan.
I move House Bill 2112 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2112 and goes to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. And, Senator, was this through your committee?
No, we didn't get to it.
All right. Any discussion? Do you have any objections? No objections. Senator Duncan, would you carry this bill?
No. Or Metzger, Courtney, we're on that committee. They
oh, yeah?
Like to,
right. Okay. Senator Metzger? Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Happy to,
okay, Senator Metzger will carry that.
Okay.
And House Bill 2339. Alice Phelan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Alice Phelan, and I'm the director of the Court Community Justice Services Division of the Oregon Judicial Department. And I'm sorry, let me pass out my testimony to your staff. I'm here speaking in support of House Bill 2339, A and Gross. This bill was introduced at the request of the Judicial Department. It addresses two issues related to domestic relations cases. The first part of the bill, Section 1, addresses the expanding funding, the expanded use of the mediation and conciliation fee that is collected currently now by our local counties. We are requesting that we would expand the uses of those fees to include parent education, custody evaluation, and other interventions for parents who are in court on domestic relations matters. Currently, those fees under the statute can only be used for mediation and conciliation services if you're looking at a strict interpretation of the statute. What is actually the case in several of our counties that our judges and the counties have interpreted that parent education is essential to participation in the mediation process, so they are using a portion of those fees for the parent education program. In addition, in several counties, they're also using those fees for the custody evaluations. Most notably in Multnomah County, for a number of years, the fees have been used for custody evaluations. All of these services are used with the intent of providing that the parents coming into court on a domestic relations matter have an opportunity to address the issues related to parenting time and custody visitation in a way that can assist the children in having a suitable custody and parenting time arrangement after the parents are divorced or separated. We are requesting that there be an expansion of the fees so that we could be using it for the parent education custody evaluation. Section 2 of the bill would clarify that not only in parenting time and custody evaluation mediation do we have to provide a mediation orientation, but also in other domestic relations matters. It came to our attention from our colleagues in the domestic violence community that there were some of the domestic relations cases that were financial issues were not required to go to mediation orientation. We agreed with them that it was important that there be a mediation orientation, and therefore we included Section 2 in the bill. I recommend that you support the bill, and I'm willing to answer any questions.
All right, so you're not increasing fees, you're just expanding the use of the existing fees.
We are not increasing fees, yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a whole bunch of extra money? Is that why you think you need to expand the uses of it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, the counties do not have a lot of extra money, but what the counties have found is that for some families, rather than going to mediation, it's more appropriate to go to custody evaluation, and that actually it's maybe if they go to mediation and it doesn't work, then they're looking around trying to find out how do they fund a custody evaluation. So when the judge determines that it's more appropriate to use another kind of intervention, we think it's more cost effective to be able to go right to that use of the funds. In addition, over in Eastern Oregon, we certainly have found from the judges we've heard there is those programs are set up is that they need the flexibility to provide for a range of options that otherwise they wouldn't have without this statutory language.
Okay.
Work session. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2339A goes to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2339A goes to the floor with a Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion. Any opposition? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Burry, would you be so kind?
I would be so kind.
Thank you very much. Senator Burry will carry that one. All righty. Okay, if you're here for 2352, the amendments that are being proposed for that are not ready yet, so.
What did you say?
2352, bottom of page 1.
2352. I wonder, do you have it?
It got pulled off the docket. Off the agenda, excuse me.
Oh, are we working? They're working from a different one.
Pardon me?
Are they working from a bit different?
Yeah, that was taken off.
Okay, because it's still on my old one. So.
Okay.
Okay.
He's jumping around because he's doing my bill, which is very nice. I'm not being on the stage at 10 o'clock tonight like you guys are.
All right, Senate Bill 81.
Work session.
Andrea?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 81, as you recall, we already had, actually, I believe, a public hearing and then a further work session where we talked about the Dash 3 amendment. The Dash 3 amendments basically take out a big part of the bill and leave in a very important part, which is the establishment of the Department of Justice work group to develop standards for batterers intervention programs. In addition, it leaves in or adds a part to the bill which says that a county may substitute supervision of offenders, of probation offenders, may substitute those people for people in a domestic violence intervention program and in an existing program and get funding through the state that way. So they can make the choice between people that are on probation for certain kind of crimes and use that money for supervision of domestic violence intervention participants.
Right, and what was the the objection to the bill that stood? There was some concern about funding of certain...
Right, the original bill basically took some existing programs, talked about a big group together, decided what worked and didn't work in those programs, and set out standards, and then made the program itself voluntary, but said that if you did a domestic violence intervention program, it should look like this. And apparently we can't get agreement from all of the parties involved as to whether or not that's going to work. So what's left is everybody agrees that standards need to be developed for these programs. So regardless of if you go into a diversion program or you're convicted of domestic violence, oftentimes a judge will order you to go into domestic batterers intervention treatment. And what this bill would do would be to set up, to have the Attorney General's office develop standards so that any program around the state, it can't just be called batterers intervention. There's certain standards that you have to meet.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the work session.
Yes, sir, we are.
Move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 81.
All right, Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 81. Discussion? Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 81 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 81 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendations or discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. Order. And anybody desiring to carry that bill? Senator Courtney will carry the bill.
Baseball bill. Baseball bill.
Thank
All right.
You.
Time to change counsel. So we'll be in just a brief 3-minute recess. back to order. Public hearing on House Bill 2102. Anybody from the Oregon Military Department here?
I'm not. Yes.
Anybody here on 2102? House Bill 2102, going once, going twice.
And,
three of the bills.
Wait, hold on.
Hey, oh, hey. Public hearing on House Bill 2175.
Testify, 2105.
2175? Military Department didn't show up, that's not my problem. We can call the general.
Well, we got a general on the committee. We got two of them. Is anybody signed up for that?
2175.
I'll just talk on it just to do it.
We're exempting people from execution. That's pretty
good. This is a good bill. Mr. Chair, I move 2175. A vote is set.
Public hearing.
I like it when nobody shows up. Can Moose Master.
Captain, I don't care about the bill. I don't care about their bill.
Well, maybe they even know.
That's what we have, public hearings, notices, 24-hour notice. Pay attention.
They're fighting the wars for us.
2175.
Make up one.
Would you at least send it to Ways and Means? Have somebody, yeah, we sent it to Ways and Means.
Good for.
It's really low.
Have somebody in our office call the Adjutant General's office, ask them if they want this bill or not.
Nobody showed up, so John.
2102. Tell them no one showed up and I'm a little irritated. I'm going to kill their bill if they don't show up. See if they do. They may want to kill it.
I will testify.
All right, 2175. Do you have anybody signed up for this one?
I moved.
Nobody signed up for this bill. Dead bill.
Oh, now we're making progress.
Yes. Who says we need to shut down judiciary?
Well, it's 2175.
What you want to do with that 24-hour notice rule, please?
Wait till we go to 1 hour. We can really smoke these things.
Public hearing 2243. Anybody here on 2243?
I was born in 2243. Let me get my file before you say. Oh, well, they're lucky they're alive. You better not be walking up to that witness stand. You better be running up there.
I mean, did I say 2243? I'm sorry, 2243. Isn't that what I said?
Yeah.
I don't know.
2243. You know who you are, right?
We know who we are.
Please identify yourself. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dan Kaplan, Deputy Administrator at the Senior and Disabled Services Division. With me is Roy Fredericks, the manager of the Estates Administration Unit at the Department of Human Services. We're here testifying in support of House Bill 2243A. The Estates Administration Program, the Estates Collection Program, is a program that's required by federal law and state law. It is a program that requires us to make a claim in the estates of deceased Medicaid recipients to attempt to collect back some portion of the medical assistance costs paid on behalf of those recipients. In the 2001-03 budget, we are anticipating that we'll collect approximately $25 million of other funds through the Estates Collections Program. House Bill 2243 does several things. First, it requires personal representatives to notify the Department of Human Services Estates Administration Unit of their appointment. Second, it exempts from time limits on claims the department in the event that individuals applying for medical assistance fail to identify assets that they have at the time of their application. And third, it allows or requires the department to attempt to collect from the estates of individuals under the age of 55 if they're permanently institutionalized. These changes bring the state into compliance with federal law. In addition, they will generate an estimated $1.6 million of other funds, and that money is anticipated both in the budget of the Ways and Means co-chairs and in the governor's revised budget.
Okay, work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill. Are there amendments?
No amendments.
I move House Bill 2243 and gross Senate floor do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2343 to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation. A and gross. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Thank you very much. Bye.
All righty, that one's done. Anybody from the military department here? Representative Walker.
He's here.
You're here for what purpose?
It's Keel 2175.
2175 is dead.
We just, 175 is your bill?
No, maybe we didn't.
All right. Public hearing. 175.
Did we vote for this one?
There's one.
No, he said dead.
2175. No, I killed that bill. I put dead right here. Dead. See, dead, dead,
yeah,
dead.
We did vote that.
2243 you just voted for.
He did.
Yeah.
So this is carried.
Who wants to carry that last little Hummer? Senior Service Division. Senator Duncan, would you carry that?
Sure.
The oldest one. Okay. Senator Duncan will carry that bill. Representative Walker, it's getting towards the end of session, so...
Yes. This is getting towards the end of session, so you're getting goofy?
No, I started out goofy.
Oh. Well, we're getting goofy in our committees as well, okay. So I'll try to be quick. We're hearing all about Senate Bill 485 in our Labor Committee, and I thought I was going to go to sleep, so it's giving me a chance to come out. Mr. Chair, I'm Vicki Walker, State Representative, House District 41. House Bill 2175 comes to you from the House with only 3 no votes. It is a bill that's very simple. It allows a debtor the right, excuse me, I'm still breathing hard. It allows the debtor the right to exempt their earned income credit through bankruptcy proceedings or collection proceedings. And the reason we do that, we want to do that, is because the federal earned income credit is received on a tax return when you file your tax return. It's a refundable credit, so if you're not owed a refund, you get it because you have a low income or you have children or both, and it increases based on those factors. Earned income credit being a refundable credit under the bankruptcy exemption statutes in Oregon, there are the federal bankruptcy law, but also Oregon has different statutes that exempt things. It's not exempt. It's not considered like welfare assistance. Many states do consider that as welfare assistance, but Oregon does not. Trustees in bankruptcy don't like taking that credit. Judges don't like taking it. And in fact, one of the judges I work for wrote an opinion that said, given the state of Oregon law, trustees have the right to go after that money. I think it's a matter of fairness. For low-income families, the credit was enacted to help families hurt by rising food and energy prices. We certainly have that today, as we did in the 70s when this was enacted. This bill brings fairness to the process because currently, when you file bankruptcy, if you have a retirement plan, that's exempt. If you're a low-income wage earner, it's not. So there was no opposition to this bill in the House, and only 3 no votes on the floor. I think
voted against it on the floor.
Representative Schrader, Morgan, and Winters, and they voted no after Representative Witt got up and gave this speech about how anybody who's owed taxes should get that exempt. And then he went and voted yes for the bill. So
this is basically a taxpayer who's gone bankrupt but still has an earned income tax credit coming back to them.
Right.
And you just simply want it to be such that we would not take that earned income tax credit away from them.
Correct. Because it is for low-income wage earners. And it's for anyone who's not in bankruptcy, too. It also exempts them from collection from a collection agency. And they did not object to the bill.
All righty. Work session.
Chair, I move House Bill 3175 engrossed Senate Public Affairs Recommendation.
All right. Senator Courtney moves the now resurrected House Bill 2175 engrossed to the floor of the Senate to do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Chair.
Senator Byrd.
Yes. I'm just wondering, you know, this is about, talking about people who are in bankruptcy here, right? Is that right?
Or poor people who are subject to collection.
Anyway, they're obviously they owe the money to somebody. And they're owing money to someone, otherwise they wouldn't be in bankruptcy or they wouldn't be subject to debt collection.
Correct.
So it isn't like there's nobody getting hurt here. It's just somebody else is now getting hurt if we pass this bill. Correct?
Well, I'm not sure I would characterize it that way, Mr. Chair and Representative Byer. Senator Byer. I mean, certainly in bankruptcy there are losers. There are always losers, and sometimes it's very difficult to sit there as a court reporter and watch that happen. But we have certain exemptions in the law for a purpose, because debtors need a fresh start. These are the poorest of the poor. We're not talking about people who have a lot of money here, and this refundable credit helps them, as Congress intended, with rising food and energy prices, with their children. It's not a significant amount of money. I think the average refundable credit is about $2,000. I did provide to you testimony from Richard Slotty. His written testimony, has pneumonia today, so couldn't be here, but he indicates that the U.S. Trustee's office is in favor of the bill. I mean, someone, yes, is going to get the short end of the stick. Always in bankruptcy.
Transferring from the person who's a deadbeat and didn't pay their debt in bankruptcy to someone else who's trying to collect the money they have done to that person. Now we're going to shaft that person instead of the deadbeat who didn't pay their bill.
Might I respond, Mr. Chair? I'll be brief. Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, I would like to remind you that the deadbeats that file bankruptcy are attorneys, doctors. I've seen it. I've seen businesses file bankruptcy. These people exempt their pension plans. They get to protect that pension plan, but the poor folks who don't have the ability to set aside money in a pension plan merely get this refundable credit that that Congress has authorized that they get, and it gets taken away from them. So in that sense, everyone who files bankruptcy is a deadbeat, but some are worse than others.
All right. The motion is before the committee to move the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Byer indicates he's a no vote. Any other no votes? No other no votes. Motion
passes. Who wants to carry that?
No.
Senator Courtney will carry
Thank
the bill.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had one other bill in front of your committee.
Which one is that?
2170.
That
one came to you on a unanimous vote.
Yeah, that one is not going to be heard today.
It's not going to be heard today? Oh.
You have a small problem with the Department of Administrative Services.
Well, that surprises me because they signed off on the amendments.
I understand.
I'll have a conversation with you later then. Thank you very much.
That was the appropriate response, yes.
Thank you, Representative Walker.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. One out of two is not bad.
One out of two is not bad.
All right. Public hearing, 2398. Thank you, Vicki. Public hearing, 2398.
The motion all-star would be unbelievable.
If you would just identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Richard Templeton. I'm with the Office of Mental Health Services with the Mental Health Division.
Okay.
Here to speak in favor of House Bill 2398. Essentially, it maintains most of the features for the release of information in relation to people who are being held prior to a civil commitment hearing or subsequent to a civil commitment order or recertification of civil commitment. As I read the bill, the main crux of it is that it would allow what's being referred to as comfort information to be released to family members of a person who is being held in involuntary treatment. If they are unable to give their own consent, then the minimal information of their presence within the facility can be given to a family member. Additional information can be given, but it would require the consent or authorization of disclosure from the person who's being held.
Okay, so If I'm institutionalized as a result of being in the Legislative Assembly and cannot communicate to my family that I'm institutionalized for one reason or another, this will help me, right?
Yes.
Okay. That was a joke, guys. Okay, all right. Council, any want to share any more? John McCullough is supposed to be here, but this is currently not, so.
Yes, I thank you, Chair Minnis. This is a bill that came from the Interim Judiciary Committee's Civil Commitment Work Group. This bill is supported by the Oregon Psychiatric Association and family members. It was opposed by the Oregon Advocacy Center on the House side. The only real change that it makes to existing Oregon law is to allow the facility to pass along information about an individual, that an individual is in the facility if they're unable to consent. But that can be overridden if the physician feels that that would be put the patient in jeopardy, for example, if the patient was a victim of domestic violence or something like that. It does favor designation of persons to receive information and the use of a mental health directive whereby the individual can in advance specify how they want information dealt with in the event that they should become incapacitated.
All right. Is the Advocacy Center here today? So they're not signing up in opposition to this. Right. Committee, everybody okay with this?
I'm okay.
Everybody okay? Okay, work session, 23.
Sure. I move House Bill 2398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2398 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, unamended. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Sure. Volunteers to carry the bill.
No volunteers. Senator Barr will carry it. Thank you, Senator. It's a miracle. Well, at least someone was here to talk on it. Otherwise, it would have been dead. Okie dokie. Public hearing 2613. Anybody here on 2613? Going once, twice, three times. Extends the delivery date for stipulations to prior to the convening of the Board of Property Tax Appeals. Okay. Dead bill, 2613, DOA.
I love this place.
All righty. House Bill 2840, public hearing. Anybody here on 2840? Come forward and tell yourself. Speak. Share your heart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. We have no position with respect to House Bill 2840. We have seven county judges who currently exercise judicial functions, all of whom are in Eastern Oregon. Six of those county judges support this legislation. One of those county judges does not. Therefore, we have no position on the bill, but I'm here to answer any questions the committee may have.
What does the bill do?
It provides, Mr. Chair, that these county judge positions will be nonpartisan.
Okay. Are they partisan now? County judges are partisan offices?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Mesker, yes, they are.
Work session.
Move 2840.
Senator Duncan moves. House Bill 2840, unamended. Floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
What party is the one there that doesn't like it yet?
Any objection?
Yeah, just for the record, the opponents, proponents are both in my district, so.
Oh.
I'm not carrying this thing.
So you're also in no position on the bill.
I'm no position on this bill.
All right, no objection to the bill. Ask the Senator Duncan. We'll be glad to carry this bill. Moving right along, we have 10 minutes left in this phase. Public hearing, House Bill 3059. Wait, skip that one. Let's go back. Back up, regroup. 3156. That's your.
What are you doing?
3156. We are the paragon of efficiency here today. So we are. This is Representative Wilson's bill. Representative Wilson in the bill? Mm-hmm. The building? Representative Wilson, going once?
Wait, I'll testify for it.
Going twice?
Wait, I'll testify for it.
Sure?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. What is it, sir?
It modifies the requirements for a state agency that's required to conduct an oral hearing on the proposed administrative rule.
Yes, counsel, tell me about this bill.
There's a bill in my office. This is a pretty limited applicability. It does arise apparently from some rulemaking in the natural resources area. It would only apply. Well, in rulemaking, an agency is not required to hold a public hearing. They're required to take comments, but they're not required to have a public hearing. If 10 or more individuals or an organization representing 10 or more individuals request that the agency have a hearing, then the statute reads that the agency shall hold a hearing. This would apply if the individuals who requested that the agency hold a hearing request that they do that in a geographic area, then they would need to hold a hearing in that particular geographic area.
Right.
That's what I meant to say.
All right. Good. Work session, 3156.
Move to the floor. Do pass recommendation, 3156, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3156 before the Senate with a do pass recommendation. It again is unamended. Discussion, any objections, hearing none. So, and Senator Harper, I'm sure you'll be glad to read that. Fine. Congratulations.
It actually comes from Southern Oregon.
Oh, Wilson knows me.
All right, 3398. You guys are getting the message, right?
Oh, the green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. What House Bill 3398 does is it would set a 2-year statute of limitations for a due process hearing in a special education matter. Currently, the state of Oregon does not have a statute of limitations. A case came from the Sherwood School District regarding reimbursement of educational expenses. The school district ordered that it was outside the 2-year statute of limitations that had been applied by hearings officers. It went up to federal court. The federal district judge said we did not have a statute. He imposed a 6-year statute of limitations. We are requesting a 2-year. The chair has asked me to do some research to find out how many states, other states, have a 2-year. I'm handing out some testimony from the Department of Education. Roughly about a third of the states that we looked at have a 2-year, another third have a 1-year, and some states even have a 60-day statute of limitations. We chose a 2-year because the parties concerned on this, the Oregon Advocacy Center, disability advocacy groups, are not opposing the bill, and the bill came off the House floor 41-0. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are you opposed or for?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I submitted written testimony from Craig Rossler, superintendent of Silver Falls School District, outlining the practical problems at the school district level, and we'll leave it to you to read them unless you'd like me to take you through them. But we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Work session.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 3398, Engross, House Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3398, Engross, to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections to the 2-year statute of limitations? All right. No objections. Who wants to carry that puppy? Senator Burdick. It is?
Got your name on it.
Is this a gun stuff? No?
Representative.
Oh, I did this for you guys. Hey.
Carry it.
Don't say I didn't ever do anything for you. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll carry it. Getting lost in the process here, you know what I'm saying? Yes, I am. All righty now, let's see. 3745. That's yours, Marilyn. Appeals to sunset. Dealing with taking early child into protective custody. Why is there a sunset in the first place? Everybody looking at their SMS here. House Bill 2599-1999 session allows police or employee of the state officer to search children's families to detain a child, an unmarried individual under 18, if it appears that the child has run away from home. This current law requires the person taking child into protective custody do the following. One, release the runaway to the parent, guardian, or a shelter that has agreed to provide services to a runaway child, which does not include a juvenile detention center. And two, determines whether release to the parent or guardian or release to a shelter is in the best interest of the runaway. Did you sign up?
No.
You can't talk in. No, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. We did not sign up for this bill, but I can tell you that last session this change was made and the sunset was put on because of concerns raised by the Juvenile Rights Project. We're taking no position on this bill, but we do not oppose the sunset being taken off. The concerns that we raised about this bill, we think were met during the interim.
What was the concern?
The concerns were that, well, first of all, the first concern was that what they were amending this law to do, we felt the police already had statutory authority to do. And so we didn't feel that a change was needed in the law. The proponents felt that it was needed just to make it clearer to police that they had the authority, they did have the authority to pick up children who were on the run. And the second concern that we had was that this was going to be used as a way to, essentially a pretext to stop kids that were out on the street to find out if they were runaways or not.
All right. Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate it.
I move House Bill 3745 to the floor. Do pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill
3745.
Unamended to the floor of the Senate. Do pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. Senator Metzger, would you?
Sure.
Thank you. You're doing such a fine job.
Thank you very much.
What time is it?
Mr. Chair, 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock, straight up.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, sir. I'm really coming. I think you should be okay. I'm looking to get done pretty early.
Okay.
Start at 5.
All right. We're going to be in recess until 5.